The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session 351. A funny thing happened on my way to the temple. A story about Mormons and Jews and becoming both. Part 1. Being Mormon. A paper presented by Clifton Jolly.
Good afternoon. If everybody will be seated, the entire family be seated. I'm William Stanford. I'm affectionately known as the publisher of Sunstone, yet I haven't really published anything. But I've had the definite pleasure of attending a number of symposiums. I particularly have the opportunity of going to Dallas. Our first entry into Dallas, and well, our speaker was one of the speakers at Dallas. I'll just say this: after I saw that show, I asked to be the chairman. I was the only volunteer chairman there was. It seems that we're honored with a very dynamic speaker, and he has a subject that actually he started to speak on in Dallas. He never got to it. He didn't get to his subject. Again. But what I did see was this man travels with an entourage. The most beautiful people. So I had to come see this again. Beautiful. Fantastic. And he had video, audio of his own. So maybe what you read on the internet when you look up Clifton Jolly, see what you see. And I printed, and I think it was a fair job that Dan did in the program, so I'm not going to reiterate. I'm going to say that the man is a businessman, too. The background of writing and didn't hurt him in the business field. He was the founder and the president of his own, it looked like his own communication company that appears to be a rather large one. Maybe we can get an explanation of that. We're limited on time at the moment, so I just want to point out a couple other things that I recently had the opportunity of building the web pages for the first 100 issues of Sunstone. Issue number 2. There happens to be a poem in there. The genealogist as Scrooge, Clifton Holt Jolly. I'll just read a couple lines. You find that issue on our website and watch what you see. I am Southern people. Always thought the underpinning tendrils of my person knotted tight upon the cogs of abolition machine until my grandma, ma, unacquainted with the consequences, even now paid $200 to a British genealogist who traced me smack into the closet of a Southern skeleton who, before death's diet drove him thin, sat fat as any cat in old Virginia. Who else would show up here in a white suit?
That's
true. Excellent. So I'll get out of the way and let's welcome Clifton Jolly.
Thank you very much. If you go to find that poem, as is frequently the case, the mistakes that people make about you tell the better truth. The original title of that poem is The Genealogist as Scourge, but Scrooge works about as well. And I wrote that poem to humiliate my children, which is the task that God has given parents to do. That my children are, they have politics just to the left of Karl Marx. And so when they discovered that their great-great-grandfather was in fact a slaveholder, not an abolitionist designed on setting people free, they were so horrified that what could I do but publish the fact? And then years later, on my honeymoon with my wife, the woman who is not their mother, although their mother is here, and I will be speaking of them both, as befits a good Mormon husband of many women, consecutively. My great-great-grandfather was a polygamist, another fact my children don't like me to talk about. But when we were honeymooned in the Turks and Caicos Islands on an island called Provost. And as we got off the plane, we saw that the name had been shortened to Provo, where lives the genealogist for our family, as it turns out. And I thought, what an unlikely happy accident to have come all this way to find myself home in Provo. On our way from the airport, the cab driver leaned out the window and shouted to a construction crew. He said, "Hey, John Jolly!" And this construction worker, black as my shirt, waved back at us. And our driver, nearly as black as my shirt, waved at him. And my wife leaned forward and said, "What was that gentleman's name?" He said, "John." She said, no, his last name. And he said, "Oh, Jolly, like mine." She inquired. This was plenty of information for me. He said, how do you spell your last name?" He said, "Jolley." She said, "Well, that is my husband's last name," not realizing that it was theoretically hers now as well. I, wanting to get into the conversation, leaned forward and said, "We must be related." To which he replied, "I suspect there's another reason." Well, as I talked to him about this happy coincidence, I asked him where his people were from. He said, "Well, they were originally from the other island, the one closer off the shore. Bermuda, the Bahamas. They were originally from the Bahamas." Well, many of the slaves at the time of abolition, at the time of the freeing, escaped to this island, the Bahamas. And not having last names, because slaves didn't have last names, if they had been owned by someone they didn't particularly hate, they took the owner's last name. My great-great-grandfather at this time was freeing his slaves, having been recently converted to Mormonism, and moving to Utah. An interesting historical detail, which my wife kept me from sharing with our cab driver, which has nothing to do with my paper. A funny thing happened on my way to the temple, which is, by the way, not my title, but I think that was given to me. You gave it to me, didn't you? Yet when I couldn't, when coming up with the title seemed the least of my worries. A story about Mormons and Jews and becoming both. I have a story to tell you. It's a love story, and it's about the people and the places, the occupations, relations, and the religions that I love. It's about my family. It's about me. Ken Godfrey, my supervisor when I taught Mormon Seminary in Tempe, Arizona, was schooled as a historian, and because, you know Ken, don't you, Mike? Yeah. Is he still alive? Why isn't he here? All of my family and friends are. Family and friends, raise your hands, would you please? See? I was afraid I might not have an audience with... Because history can be difficult and can offend, He used to begin his speeches and sermons by saying, I want to start out by telling you that I love you. And if I say anything that offends you, please remember that it was said by someone who loves you. So let me begin by saying, if any of you are offended by what I say, remember, this is not your story, it's my story. But because you are here, leading me to believe that you are Mormon, or used to be Mormon, or wish you weren't Mormon, or can't figure out how to be anything but Mormon, you are the people of my story. And the story goes like this. There was this Jew, and he was shipwrecked on an otherwise uninhabited island. And because he was devout, the first thing he does is build himself a temple. Now, the best friend of my youth, Michael Quinn, tells me I may need to explain that Reformed Jews, such as myself, refer to our synagogues as temples. I don't know why. More significantly, my wife, who was raised a Reformed Jew, as I was raised a Mormon, who is the daughter of a cantor, as I am the son of a bishop, she doesn't know why either. Were this an academic paper instead of my story, I might have done the research to find out why, but I didn't. As a Mormon, not knowing makes me a little uncomfortable, because the experience of testimony meetings and decades of religious education as a Mormon have taught me that I'm supposed to know. Jews are not similarly afflicted. Reformed Jews, unlike their Orthodox cousins and conservative Mormons, believe that most things are beyond our knowing for sure. So the Mormon part of me wishes I had looked up why Reformed Jews call synagogue temples and believes there is a good reason. The Jewish part of me knows that whatever the reason, it probably isn't very good, that certainly it is the subject of debate. While as a Jewish Mormon writer, conflicted between my Mormon and more recent Semitic educations, I'm simply practical. Were it not for Reform Judaism's temples, I wouldn't have a title for this paper. So this Jew is shipwrecked, and he spends 10 years alone on the island, until one day he's rescued by a luxury cruise ship that has wandered off course. And as luck would have it, the captain is Jewish. And when he lands on the island, he finds not one, but two Reformed temples. And he asks the shipwrecked Jew, "You're alone?" "Wouldn't you know," replies the Jew. "All alone these 10 years without a goyim to pay retail. And you built both these temples. Who else was to help me? I'm alone," complains the shipwreck. "But then why two?" asks the captain. "That temple," says the Jew, "is the one I attend, and that one I will have nothing to do with." Usually in a Gentile audience, we don't get this much of a response. But because we are the adopted chosen people, we plug into Jewish humor in the way that other Gentiles don't. One of the most difficult things for my father-in-law to understand, who at the time I met him was retired from the cantorate, but was still known as one of Reformed Judaism's foremost cantors, one of the hardest things for him to understand about the Mormon story I told him was excommunication. "So you say these friends of yours said things that your leaders didn't like." Before I realized how foreign to him was the very idea that a hierarchy of authority could even exist, there is no such thing in Reformed Judaism, much less have the power or the desire to excommunicate family and friends, I thought I simply hadn't been earnest enough in my explanation. So I continued to try to persuade him that bad thinking can have the power of bad living. that wickedness frequently disguises itself as eloquence, that a church must protect believers from the devices of the deceiver. Yes, he replied, I get why you do it. I just don't understand how it's done. How do you stop Mormons from being Mormons? In the Passover Seder of Reformed Judaism, the Haggadah instructs on how to teach four kinds of children: the wise child, the irreverent child, the simple child, and the disobedient child, to whom we say, this is what the Lord did unto me, not unto you, but to me. The story belongs to us whose story it is. We are Mormons, we are Jews. One of the paradoxes of Zeno asks, how does one move from where one is to where one is not? When the Dalai Lama was asked which religion was best for people, he replied, the one into which they are born, karma. Which is why when Wolf alleges that you can't go home anymore, he's right only because you never really leave home. Home can't kick you out, and you can't go away without it. We carry the emblems of our family and our faith in the meat we call muscle, in the burden we call bone, in the blood that only those who do not love us, who are not our family and our faith, that only that other should think to shed. So you're the people I love. You're the ones who make me crazy. You're both the ones I like and the ones I will have nothing to do with. But regardless, you all are my kin. One of the lessons the priesthood leaders of Mormonism appear to have failed to learn is that the people who most offend you are most your people. The members of your ward, the apostles, these are the people who piss you off. These are the people who are your kin. You shouldn't excommunicate these people. You should keep them close, because this is the offense that family gives. These are the offenses of our family. Which is part of why I can say that without knowing you, I love you. And I forgive you. Or at least I'm trying to. Because every love story has a little disappointment in it. And my people, on my mother's side, that's the Moyles of Alpine, and on my father's side, the Jollies of southern Utah, have been disappointed with the church from the very beginning of their having been a church. And we are disappointed still. Myself and all of my children, with the possible exception of Aaron, my very best child. But only because he has most recently returned home. Aaron, who is there, just got back from Iraq a few days ago. And he says he came back to hear this paper. Good children know what to say to their parents. If Cantor Wineflash were here, he'd shrug. He'd say, who am I to be disappointed with God? Which beggars the point that were it not for the disappointment of the Jews, we'd probably have no Bible. You can make a case for the possibility that the first five books, the Torah, were written because Jews were unwilling to trust God to get it right. And the Talmud, which is supposed to explain the Torah, was written because Jews were unwilling to trust one another to get it right. Cantor Wineflash would say, who am I to question God? And I would reply, which is why God sent me to you, so there would be someone to ask the questions. And Cantor Wineflash would reply to me in Hebrew. He'd say, My theory is that Mormons most distinguish ourselves as a chosen people not by the ways in which we are peculiar, but by the ways in which we resemble other chosen peoples. And one of those ways is the mistake we make in believing we have a right, nay, a calling, to be disappointed. Our church leaders say it to us in our preposterous priesthood courts, and we say it in turn to our children. But who are we really to be disappointed? And if you look over here, you'll be able to see my children rolling their eyes, because they can remember how frequently I claim to be disappointed in them, which is a mistake I want to publicly correct today by saying it wasn't true. It was never true. I was worried. I was afraid. So I told you that I was disappointed with you, hoping that it would hurt you. And I hope it did, because God knows talking about my disappointment never made you behave. The Mormon euphemism for disappointment is conduct unbecoming of a Latter-day Saint. Or, if you teach in the church education system, as I did, poor judgment. When I taught seminary and institute and at BYU, I was forever being told, usually after I published in Sunstone or Dialogue, what poor judgment I had exercised, which is two kinds of problem. First of all, it's not a criticism that beggars response. There just simply isn't enough detail in it. And the second problem is that aside from sins against the Holy Ghost, poor judgment is the only sin that I can think of which it is impossible to repent. If you're screwing your neighbor's wife, you can simply stop. If you've stolen your neighbor's cow, you can give it back. But how do you leave off having piss-poor judgment? But I promised you a love story. So getting back to love stories, like all the stories of love that I first loved and most love still, this story begins traditionally, ritually, once upon a time. Fundamental religionists claim that their stories are true. Partly this is because they believe them to be, and partly it's a claim that discourages criticism when the story just isn't very good. Because when a story becomes good, when it really cooks and makes you impatient to turn the page and slow to want it to end, such a story becomes unmanageable in a variety of ways. I'm reminded of a story I once heard about art criticism in the BYU art department. I have a prejudice about artists who speak about their art. I don't think they should be allowed to. When our children tell us that they are going to become artists, we should cut out their tongues. Because when artists speak about their art, they inevitably become self-serious and stupid. And they make us feel stupid for having been moved by the art. A good example is Edgar Allan Poe's explanation about how he wrote The Raven. You come away from that long, dull, well-considered but unconvincing essay certain of one thing: you can't write poetry that way. But a drunk druggie probably wishes that he had. He doesn't want to admit that drugs and alcohol can be a greater inspiration than one's own discipline, any more than religionists want to believe our prophets are wild, unwashed, woolly men who stagger in from the desert and fail to find Captain Kidd's treasure by staring at a stone kept safe by the inspiring darkness of their cap. Or used to. So these artists at BYU were standing around looking at this painting of some buffalo. And the artists were saying the sort of stupid things artists say about art. How much better the painting would be if the buffalo were otherwise arranged and composition. And the kid who had painted the buffalo, he was arguing, but that's how they were standing. And the artists were explaining about composition and balance, and the kid, frustrated, just blurted out, "Buffalo don't know squat about composition and balance." More than 30 years ago, I took a workshop with the novelist Richard Erno, who one day was reading a story of a young woman in the class, and he stopped to say, "Well, this is simply too coincidental. It's just too unbelievable." And the young woman, who probably knew nothing at all about Buffalo either, nevertheless blurted out, "But it did happen, Professor Erno. It happened to me." Professor Erno smiled and said, "Well, of course it did, dear. It's your life. And your life has the advantage of being real, so it doesn't have to be believable. Art, on the other hand, is at some level false, which is why it has the obligation to make us believe in it." At least 30 years later, that's what I think he said. Although I think it sounds more like what I think, and when I think about it enough, I realize that it sounds like nothing I believe. I have no idea whether or not the story I am about to tell you is any more true than my recollection of that story, but I am absolutely certain that it is my story. So, once upon a time, I was a Mormon. And although it confuses the story and makes too much of the truth, I will tell you that I believe myself to be a Mormon still, as does my rabbi. I suspect my apostles would not be so quick to agree, but it's not their story either. And although mine is not a story my apostles have much use for, except perhaps as a negative example, mine is not an angry story. Not anymore. Well, not as much. Because the last time I gave it, my son Aaron recently returned home alive from Iraq, told me that I sounded too much like everybody else who whines about the church. Well, Aaron knows how to get to me. I don't so much mind him describing my careful academic analysis as whining, but when he accuses me of sounding like everybody else, so I've rewritten around the angry parts. You'll tell me how successful I've been. And a lot of what I've written may not be right at all, because the one thing I've learned is how much there is in life you can never really, really know. And unlike Arthur Miller, I don't make that as a sweet observation by the dead standing lonely on a rainy afternoon in some cemetery. I say it because it is one of the revelations of my life, that more and more the truth of how little we can be certain of is with us. More and more we are certain of less and less. Or perhaps, as a colleague in church education once told me, there is less and less of which we are more and more certain. What I'm most certain of is that all of us are dying, and all of us are in pain. I learned that first from Maggie Smith, my mentor late in life, who cautioned me against judging too harshly the myopia of leadership, any more than we should be unforgiving of the congregation. The poet Philip Larkin puts it this way: we should be careful of each other. We should be kind while there is still time. We should be kind. And there are parts of what I've said and I'm about to say that may not seem kind to people who do not agree with me. But I say them because they are the only truth I have to tell. All the time realizing that they may not be your truth, and regardless of what we believe to be true, they may not be the fact. And as my father, the dentist, and my father, the psychologist, both assured me, both of them Mormon bishops, both of them men of God, happily, God will sort it out by and by, and that I believe too. So, once upon a time I was a Mormon, and I think that my mother thought of me as the Mormon. I taught seminary and institute. I wrote for the Deseret News and the Spoken Word. I published in the Ensign and in BYU Today. And my mother used to ask me, "Son boy, why don't you do more of that kind of writing?" And what she meant by that kind of writing was not my first serious publications, which were in Dialogue and Sunstone. She didn't even mean my daily columns in the Deseret News, which occasionally upset people, and occasionally the people were apostles, which is not entirely the reason I'm no longer writing for the Deseret News. Eugene England once told me that Elder Boyd Packer kept a bookmark in an issue of Dialogue. And when Gene was meeting with Elder Packer to persuade God's apostle that God's greatest Mormon essayist and apologist, who without doubt was Gene England, was worthy of employment at BYU, the issue of Eugene's participation in the founding of Dialogue came up. And Eugene asked Elder Packer for an example of what the apostle found disagreeable about Dialogue. Gene told me later that Elder Packer went to the bookshelf, took down an issue of Dialogue with a bookmark in it, and opened to a poem titled Prophet. The subtitle is from Isaiah 53, verse 2. No beauty that we should desire him. The common cripple to the south of Palmyra dreamed God the Father, the Savior's Son, and though clerical tradition predetermine his doom, can never, never, never search kids' treasure again. Stout, paunched, hook-nosed mystic though he was, who gimped his way from 14 on through the dark, deep furrows of those New York farms to Ohio, Missouri, Illinois, and beyond, he faced Gethsemane alone, crossed back from deliverance, and from an upper room above the crowd who shouted blood upon their children's heads, reached wide his trembling hands to God, was pierced, and plunging headlong into Pentecost, was dead. I resisted the temptation to rewrite that poem 30 years after its publication in 1972. I was principal of the Tempe, Arizona LDS Seminary when I received Carl Keller's letter saying that Prophet was being considered by Dialogue for publication, but that Carl had reservations regarding details of historicity. Carl Keller was arguing as to whether or not the story was true. I argued that it didn't matter. He agreed, and Bob Reese, over there someplace, agreed to publish the poem. I suggested that it might appear with a woodcut by James Christensen that was inspired by the poem. Volume 7, number 3 of Dialogue appeared in the autumn of 1972, by which time I was teaching institute in Cypress, California. The issue also included Carl Keller, a beautiful poem about his children, an editorial by Bob Reese, stories by Sam Taylor, Wayne Carver, Doug Thayer, and Don Marshall, hymns by Michael Moody, a series of sketches by James Christensen, poems by Arthur King, Iris Parker Corey, Bob Christmas, Linda Silito, John S. Harris, Bruce Jorgensen, and Clint Larson, whose homestead in Idaho I continue to believe to be among the most moving and accomplished poems written by a Mormon. My friends argue over that assessment more, I think, because Clint's ego was as large as his talent. When I returned to BYU to complete my graduate education, it was Clint I sought out to study with. The beautifully sentimental cover of that issue of Dialogue was designed by Kim Whitesides, a sweet Jesus holding a dove with a broken wing that has been recently splinted. I have never since appeared among writers and artists of such accomplishment and of such prophetic moment in my own life. And I have never since written or published anything that has had greater moment in my religious life. Bruce Jorgensen and I were classmates and friends. Linda Silito and I were classmates, and I think she hates me still. Arthur King became my mentor. Doug Thayer and Don Marshall I came to admire for their prose as well as their wives. Bob Christmas and Carl Keller became, for very different reasons and to very different ends, my ideal of the expatriate Mormon. Sam Taylor and Wayne Carver are, well, Sam Taylor and Wayne Carver. Several of John S. Harris's poems came to ache in me even more than my own. Among the board of editors and editorial staff, Mary Bradford, Richard Bushman, Ed Geary, Richard Craycroft, David Whitaker, and Eugene England, then of St. Olaf's College, whose writing changed my life almost as much as his life did. I elected to leave off Teaching Institute and to get a PhD in English, not entirely of my own choosing. I had been teaching in Southern California at the Institute associated with Cypress Community College. I was working on a master's degree, teaching. I had never before realized that for a seminary institute teacher to teach, he must yearly be approved by his stake president. I assume that the only people who find this out are the ones who don't get approved. Fundamentally, President Davis didn't think that we should be spending the Lord's money on anybody teaching things that weren't true. And in President Davis's lexicon, the untrue things I'd been teaching were, first of all, that it was not necessary to choose sacrament hymns only from the suggestions made in the hymnal, you know, at the end of the book. Since, in point of fact, those categories might be interpreted not as an indication of inspiration, but of the lack thereof. If you didn't have a choir director capable of making his or her own choices, here are some good suggestions. And secondly, that Joseph Smith and his crew had sent out for wine on the night of his martyrdom, and that said wine was not to practice the sacrament, as my own grandmother insisted, but because, as it was later recorded, their spirits were low. I intend the pun, since the canonization of the Word of Wisdom has left Mormon spirits low ever since. Well, I was stunned. Not because I had not said what I was accused of, but because I had. And I'd hoped to be able to deny something about me that my stake president had mistakenly assumed. My life in the church frequently had led me to this point of hope, that if only the people who were offended by what I did or said or thought or wrote or published understood, well, everything would be just fine. President Davis understood all right, and things weren't fine. When I stammered, "But those things are true," President Davis replied, "No, those things are facts. The facts often are separate from the truth. We employ you to teach the truth." If President Davis is alive and has a chance to hear about my report of his remarks, I'm sure his memory of what he said will differ from my own. And he'll be right. What he said probably was not so clever as what I remember. Well, even I don't believe facts teach truth. But I do believe this is my story. And I get to say what everybody says, including President Davis. Nevertheless, I was devastated. What would I tell my mother? How could I tell her what President Davis had done to the Mormon? I went to my church education supervisor for support, for reassurance, and somewhere in the conversation, as he was genuinely trying to cheer me up, he pointed out that my participation by that time on the board of editors of Dialogue was one of the things that was problematic. When I asked him how it could be possible that an academic's wedding of his religious and academic life could pose a problem, The example he gave was this. I was troubled by a poem that was published not too long ago in Dialogue. Not certain whether it was just my reading of the poem that was as offensive as I thought, I showed it to the head of church education, Joe Christensen. And he told me, what is even more troubling is that this poem was written by one of our own institute teachers. Brother Jolly, the poem described our beloved prophet Joseph Smith as a gimp. I am told by one of the rabbis with whom I studied that there is a character in Yiddish literature who kind of wanders into town, makes a lot of trouble, and then he just wanders on. My rabbi told me this story for a reason. I said to my supervisor, I'm the author of that poem. And to his credit, he replied, well, what do I know about poetry? So, everyone agreed that I couldn't continue to have the Lord spend his money on me in Southern California. And since I toyed with the idea of getting a PhD, and since there was, in my fevered imagination, a renaissance of Mormon literature going on at BYU, where many of the Mormon intellectuals I have mentioned had landed or were circling or would eventually be denied permission, I requested and was accepted to teach part-time at BYU while completing a doctorate in English. By being found unfit to teach Mormonism in California, I was found acceptable to teach it in Utah at the Lord's University. Creating such conundrums, can anyone doubt I was preparing for conversion to Judaism? To which I add the further proof, I got a PhD in English from BYU. But of course, I was preparing to retrogress, to devolve from a birthright of adoption among the currently chosen people to adoption by a formerly chosen people, and to get a PhD in English from BYU. I taught religion, I taught English, I got a PhD, and in the process I got to hang out with the brightest and the best that I've ever known, which was the best part of getting an advanced degree for me. The BYU doctoral program itself came to an end with the awarding of my degree. Or perhaps that's taking too much. Seminaries and institutes did not want me back because the nature of my PhD led them to believe I was going to go on publishing. And no one else appeared to want me either. In response to more than 100 applications, I received two tentative offers. One from a Southern Christian college so small that apparently it had missed the fact, well known to every Southern Christian, that Mormons are not Christian. And one from Jundi Shapur University in Ahfaz, Iran. Rather a good school, I was told, and a good job, were it not for the fact that 5 months after I would have arrived, the Shah fell and the first American was killed in Ahfaz. Very late in that process of my being turned out or turned away, I got an offer from BYU Hawaii, where I taught for a year prior to becoming a full-time columnist for the Deseret News, part-time writer of the Spoken Word, and the host of KUED's Civic Dialogue. Which brings us to within 20 years of me becoming a Jew. And he's thinking, again, please, no more stories about your employment, your unemployment, your publications, blah, 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 blah. So let's go back to when I was a child. As a child, I had polio. Wouldn't have walked ever had not my grandmother Holt, before she took me to the Los Angeles County Hospital with a high fever and an already unsteady gait, called for the elders. My father, the bishop in Garvan's ward would have done the same. But he was vacationing with my mother. Subsequent my polio, they never vacationed alone again. Who came to bless me were a couple of 70s from the ward, Brother Impson and Brother Silva, whose son Aaron is with us this afternoon. Aaron's right back there, hunching down now. Brother Impson and Brother Silva were more notable in my child's memory for their wives than for themselves. Sister Impson had only one eye before she got a false eye, which never looked in the right direction. She didn't always wear her patch. The single most memorable moment in my childhood was when Sister Impson forgot to wear her patch. Sister Impson, I also remember because one of the lessons she taught us in Sunday school was about the teachers who on Fast Sunday ate the crust they cut off the bread while preparing the sacrament and who that evening were run over by a truck. Aaron's nodding, yeah. Sister Silva, Aaron's mother, was just really, really mean. My life as a Mormon child was idyllic, full of the mean, threatening, one-eyed ghouls needed to populate really good stories. Stories full of danger and punishment for sin and the magic, thank God, to be healed. Sock vaccine was months away. Polio took 6 kids on my block that summer. So when Brother Impson and Brother Silva laid their hands on my head to bless me, Brother Impson and Brother Silva, for whatever reason of inspiration or situation, blessed me that I would walk. And so, as you see, I do. Crippled as a child, my parents told by doctors I would never walk again. I was made to walk by the healing blessing of the Mormon priesthood, sealed by the Holy Spirit of promise and my family's love and prayers. Now I'm a Jew, which you can guess makes for a more interesting story than it does an easy life. Drama often depends on the unexpected. Raising the dead, turning water to wine, making the lame to walk, but leaving him a gimp. The imperfect practice of priesthood power by the imperfect people of the priesthood. I've never left off being a Mormon. How could I? Most imperfectly whole as I am, by simple men whose suffering faith caused them to work a miracle in my life. And after all these years of my people being Mormons and all these miracles since. As a boy, I loved the Joseph Smith story, especially the part about him being operated on for his leg and being so brave. And when I learned the operation left him with a withered limb and a limp, that his body was not beautiful, but stained and scarred by the beatings and the tarrings of the mobs, well, I took hope in the fact that the prophet Joseph Smith was a gimp like Ed Kimball and me. And when Jean England told me of Elder Packer keeping a bookmark so as to quickly turn to my poem, my first thought, God help me, was, he's chosen me. God's apostle has chosen me as an example. From among all of these more worthy troublemakers, me. I was proud. and I was devastated. And at no time in all those years of frustrating other people, nevertheless, in no time did I become frustrated with being a Mormon. I love serving in bishoprics and high councils. I don't care what women say. I loved sitting on the stand. And the evidence of church history is that given the opportunity, so do they. Feminism on this issue is purely mean-spirited. I adored suffering those conundrums of the faith that people of our class ever suffer. You know, the brightest and the best. I was appalled by the failure of imagination and the lack of rigor of conviction expressed by them who had fled. I defended the faith. I did not look for the faith ever to defend me. But never, ever did I anticipate that the faith would attack. Back when the church began excommunicating us, I'd already worried my way into not believing excommunication is an act of love. I know the argument, but it doesn't work so well with someone who has never even been able to figure out what the balance between grace and mercy is all about, or the justification for Gethsemane and Calvary, or the whole cruel mathematic that argues for the sacrificial lamb, the Judas goat, the Jesus. My line of thinking had begun 40 years before the church began excommunicating us. When I was a child about to catch polio, I couldn't understand why Fuzzy Vickers was born a Methodist and had to suffer his way to Mormonism, if at all, and I got it free for nothing. Years later, my daughter Rachel told me that she'd stopped reading the Book of Mormon. And when I asked her why, she said because of the violence, because of the God she was learning, who seemed to get angry a lot and to hold people accountable and be rather slow to forgive. Because the people who wrote the book didn't seem to be very nice people. Sometimes they didn't seem to be nice at all. She said she wasn't sure what God would turn out to be, but she figured he would be at least as good a father as I was, and as bad a father as I was a better father than the Book of Mormon God. I told her what Arthur King had told me, that the Book of Mormon is a colonial work by a religiously immature people. She was 13. I told her what Jean England told me, that the right response of Nephi is probably the response felt by Laman and Lemuel. I told her what Levi Peterson said of God's commandment that Abraham should sacrifice his son. Levi says Abraham should have told God no. If he wanted his son dead, give him a good cancer. Take him with a fast virus. Didn't need a father sacrificing a child. Children, that's what I would tell him. Or not, depending on your behavior. Rachel, I just want you to know I've come up with more answers since then, and we should have the discussion again. By the way, none of them are better than the originals. But at the time she said this all to me, I realized that all of my work and worry had been a kind of coasting, something I did with greater ease than the harder work of the soul, the work of choosing. Not the work of seeking the will of God, but of discovering what sort of a world it was I really wanted to participate in, what kind of a world I wanted to help make, and what kind of a world was being made by the things that I believed, Mormons believed. I don't know how to respond to the way that other people believe. I do know that when I asked a Protestant minister once about salvation by grace and whether or not it creates an unhealthy emotional climate for resisting evil and doing good. He responded that it has often been argued that the hope of the doctrine, as he understood it, was that unmerited salvation creates in us an appreciation and gratitude such that we naturally do what is good. To which I replied, "Boy, do we hang out with different people." My whole life I believed in heaven, and my fundamental belief about heaven is that it's a place where we go to hang out with people we like. Kind of like BYU was back when I was, you know, stringing out my PhD, trying not to graduate. Heaven is like that. A lot of people having fun, God showing up to spoil it only once in a while. Which is why it sank in with me that there were people that I really didn't want messing with my heaven. And a lot of those people were the same people who were telling me that I was a bad person. This is the part I've toned down, Aaron. I've taken all the names out. And in spite of the fact that I would happily give you a list of the people that I do not want cluttering my celestial kingdom, the fact is that I suspect they're going to show up. Because it seems as though all of us, on God's scale, are so minutely divided from one another by the kinds of sins we choose. I don't know what Elder Packer's sins are beyond his suits and haircuts. But I hope God holds him accountable. Then again, if he'll keep the bookmark, he can come. In the last act of A Man for All Seasons, Sir Thomas More pays the headsman and encourages him not to hold back because, as he tells the headsman, "You send me to God." The self-aware cleric who overhears Sir Thomas says, "Are you so sure of that?" And Brother More replies, "God would not deny one so blithe to go to him." The church began to excommunicate us at a very bad time for me personally. My children had come all at once into adolescence. And that's one thing that the church doesn't tell you, by the way. While you're having 5 children under the age of 8 years old, the church doesn't tell you that they're all going to become 13 in the same damn year. In addition to which, my father, a stake president and a psychologist, told me when I whined to him that there are only 2 kinds of children, good ones and smart ones. And he said, "You got no stupid children." So my children all were teenagers, and my wife of more than 20 years couldn't remember why she had become a Mormon in the first place, although she was certain I had pretty much been crazy all along, which I was pretty much towards the end. Now, I don't say that ironically or metaphorically, nor as a confession. It's merely a part of my story. I was behaving very badly. Sinning, hoping that I would simply die and be sent to hell, where I was absolutely certain none of the boring people who didn't like me would show up. Separated by my family, befuddled by an enjambment of the last throes of my own adolescence, running headlong into the blossoming adolescence of my children and my church, I began to self-destruct. Had anyone in North Temple thought to inquire as to my personal convenience, I would have asked that the purge be put off. I can even imagine the conversation.
What's the time?
Oh, we're way past. I'll give you the conversation. The rest of this is at the banquet tonight. Brother Jolly, we're thinking of excommunicating some of our interesting Mormons. Most of them, by the way, are your friends. We were even considering a smallish disciplinary action of yourself. Could you check your calendar and get back to us on a good time? We've penciled in the early 90s. How's that for you? Actually, that's really rather bad for me. I've scheduled the adolescence of my whole family, a divorce, and then I plan to stop thinking for about half a decade. Not precisely a breakdown, more of a slowdown. Let's see, mid-90s, late-90s, 21st century. No. As a matter of fact, never is best for me. How does never work for you? When the church began to excommunicate my friends, I began to become a Jew. Thank you very much.